أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. We were discussing verse 190 وقاتلوا في سبيل الله الذين يقاتلونكم ولا تعتدوا إن الله لا يحب المعتدين. Fight in the way of Allah those who fight you, but do not transgress. Indeed, Allah does not like transgressors. What we said was that the verse is very clearly limiting the scope of jihad, and that is only those who fight you. You fight with them who fight you, and do not transgress in this ruling, or when you are reacting, do not transgress in your reaction. This is the meaning of la ta'tadu, do not transgress, because Allah does not like the transgressors. Now, the following verse, which says, وَقْتُلُوهُمْ حَيْثُ ثَقِفْتُمُوهُمْ وَأَخْرِجُوهُمْ مِنْ حَيْثُ أَخْرَجُوكُمْ, and kill them wherever you confront them, and expel them from where they expelled you. وَالْفِتْنَةُ أَشَدُّ مِنَ الْقَتْلِ, because fitna is graver than killing. And do not fight them near the holy mosque unless they fight you there, but if they fight you, kill them, such is the requital of the faithless. Now, some people say this verse, وَقْتُلُوهُمْ حَيْثُ ثَقِفْتُمُوهُمْ, kill them wherever you find them, has abrogated the previous verse, and that is وَقَاتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ أَلَّذِينَ يُقَاتِلُونَكُمْ, those who fight you. Why? Because this is completely general and universal. Kill them, kill all the mushrikun, wherever you find them. And expel them from where they have expelled you, because fitna, which they translate as faithlessness, as shirk, or as kufr, is worse than killing. So if you kill them, it's better than you leave them with faithlessness. Now, the question remains, how is it possible that Allah mentions in one verse something, and immediately after that, abrogates it to another ruling? We can understand that it is possible that one ruling has come in one time, for example, in Mecca, and it has been abrogated in Medina, or early days of Medina, and then later on it has been abrogated, although this is questionable. I will discuss about it in a short while. But if we have a set of verses which are all following the same theme, all has been revealed in one time, it's very clear, as Allama Tabatabai, Rahmatullah Alayhim, mentions, these verses are all coming down, or have all been revealed in one theme. The siyaq is the same. And then we say that in one verse, Allah says something, and then in the next verse, changes his mind. No, please go and kill all of them instead of killing those who fight you. So, what I mentioned last time about the view of Allama Tabatabai is that this is not about every faithless person or community. This is specifically revealed about Mushrikun of Mecca when they started fighting against the Muslimun. Then, of course, all these verses were revealed with regards to them, and it cannot be extended to other people unless we have the same situation, something like that. Allama Tabatabai has this view in other verses as well. For example, in the verses at the beginning of Surah Baqarah, إِنَّ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا سَوَاءٌ عَلَيْهِمْ أَأَنذَرْتَهُمْ أَمْ لَمْ تُنذِرْهُمْ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ. The faithless is equal for them, whether you warn them or do not warn them, they will not believe. Allama Tabatabai says this cannot be a general, universal rule, because otherwise, we should not invite anyone to Islam. It's equal for them, whether we call them or not. This is specifically about the mushrikun of Mecca, who Allah is actually informing his prophet, And this is one of the prophecies of the Quran, that they are not going to believe anymore. And because Allah has, of course, sealed their hearts because of their mischief and whatever they have done. And it cannot be extended to other people. Because if extended to other people, it means that no kafir ever would believe in Islam. So here as well, this verse is, in a sense, a permission to Muslims to fight against the Mushrikun of Mecca. And it cannot be extended to other people. This is in the first place. In the second place, it says that only fight, if we want to generalize it, it says only fight them who fight you and do not transgress this ruling. Now, what's the meaning of waqtuluhum haythu thaqiftumuhum? Means when war breaks out, of course, it's not the case that you see a sort of a group of mushrikun coming towards you, but they do not start fighting. You sit unless they attack. No. If there is war, you fight them. Wherever you find them, you kill them. This is the rule of war. This is not when there is no war. War hasn't broken out. So, وَقْتُلُوهُمْ حَيْثُ ثَقِفْتُمُوهُمْ refers to the previous verse, that those who fight you, you are allowed to fight them. And when you are fighting, when there is a war, then of course, wherever you find them, you kill them. Now, those who say, وَقْتُلُوهُمْ حَيْثُ ثَقِفْتُمُوهُمْ is actually abrogating the previous verse. They say because, of course, this verse is general in its purport. And you said, whoever of mushrikun you find. While their argument is false for two reasons. First of all, it says waqtuluhum. Hum, this pronoun refers to those who fight you. It does not refer to any mushrik. It does not refer to anyone who is faithless. It only refers to those who fight you. وَقَاتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ الَّذِينَ يُقَاتِلُونَكُمْ those who fight you. And here it says, وَقْتُلُوهُمْ and kill them wherever you find them, those who fight you. So this is one. The second thing is about nasakh. Actually, since old days we had people who did not believe that the Quran has any abrogating verse or abrogated verse. They did not believe in the concept of nasakh in the Quran. And they said that it is, first of all, logically it's not possible, and secondly, it never has happened in the Quran. And we have no verse in the Quran which implies that Allah would abrogate any of his verses. Of verses that he has revealed in the Quran. There are two verses in the Quran which some may indicate that there is nasakh in the Quran. One is Surah Nahl. وَإِذَا بَدَّلْنَا آيَةً مَكَانَ آيَةٍ وَاللَّهُ أَعْلَمُ بِمَا يُنَزِّلْ قَالُوا إِنَّمَا أَنْتَ مُفْتَرْ. When we change an ayah in place of another ayah, and Allah, of course, knows better what he sends down, they say you are accusing. You are actually an accuser. You are attributing what you say to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Well, this verse cannot be about nasakh in abrogation in the sense that we are talking about. Why? Because it is revealed in Mecca. And we didn't have any law revealed in Mecca that Prophet wanted to abrogate or the Quran wanted to abrogate. This discussion is between Mushrikun and the Prophet. And ayah here means miracle. One of the most outstanding usage of the ayah in the Quran is miracle. And when we change a miracle in place of another miracle, because they were saying that we do not believe in you unless you bring miracles like the previous prophets. إِلَّا مِثْلَ مَا أُوتِيَ رُسُولُ اللَّهِ we do not believe you unless you bring us like, for example, what Moses had, you bring us like what Jesus had. Allah says, we change our ayat. It's not the case that in every age we send the same miracle. Now we are sending a miracle to you, which is the Quran. And this Quran is enough for you as a miracle. A book has come down to you from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You cannot decide for us what miracle we have to give you. We decide what miracle. So this ayah is not about nasakh. The other ayah, which is very famous in Surah Baqarah, ma nansakh min ayatin aw nunsa, that we discussed before, and we talked about nasakh in the vein that other exegetes have discussed. But if we really want to meticulously go into this verse, it also talks about the miracles or prophets. Ma nansakh min ayatin aw nunsiha, na'ati bikhayrin minha aw mithlaha. Alam ta'lam anna Allah ala kulli shay'in qadir. Alam ta'lam anna Allah lahu mulku as-samawati wal ard. It doesn't refer to the ruling. It says that, for example, if we abrogate one of our ayat, one of the prophets, or the, as some people have said, sharaya, which were revealed before you, or we make some of the prophets or our ayat to be forgotten. Well, people forgot what Isa alayhi salam did. People forgot what Musa alayhi salam did. Now, we bring something like it or something better and equal. Anyhow, this is a point of discussion. Since old days, there has been this discussion whether there has any abrogation happened in the Quran or not. One of the major exegetes who's quoted very much by Sheikh Tusi in At-Tibyan, by Fakhruddin Razi in Mafatih al-Ghayb, is the very outstanding and knowledgeable scholar, Mu'tazili scholar, Abu Muslim Bahr al-Khurasani, who did not believe in Nasq at all. Now then Fakhruddin Razi, although he was an Ash'ari, he followed him. Allama Tawatabai, Rahmatullah Alay, of course, has the traditional view, but we know Ayatollah Khoi has also rejected the concept of Nasq in this very wide scale which the ulama have used, and he believes only one ayah in the Quran has abrogated another ayah, and that's the Ayatul Najwa, as far as I remember. So, coming to this, even if we say that Nasq happens in the Quran, abrogation happens in the Quran, it doesn't make sense that in a set of four, five, six ayah that Allah reveals all together, mentions one ruling, then abrogates it, then abrogates this ruling again in the following verse, as we will see. You see, it's not possible. And this is not the way we have to approach the Quran. We have to see what was the context, what Allah wants to tell us. And what I guess, my guess is that all these issues about abrogation of verses of jihad in the sense that we are following were to somehow legitimize the conquests which were going on after the Prophet, especially in the time of Banu Umayyah. They were not, of course, fighting for the sake of Allah. They were fighting for land. And these have been there to justify what the Muslims have been doing. Most probably, I'm not certain, I don't say this for sure, but what I can guess is that these ideas about abrogation of these verses, that yes, only fight those who fight you, or for example, this very famous verse which came at the very end of Prophet's life, لا ينهاكم الله عن الذين لم يقاتلوكم في الدين ولم يخرجوكم من دياركم أن تبروهم وتقسطوا إليهم. Allah does not forbid you about those who do not fight you for the cause of religion, and has not expelled you from your homes, that you be kind to them, you be just to them. تبروهم وتقسطوا إليهم. إنما ينهاكم الله عن الذين قاتلوكم في الدين. Allah forbids you to befriend with those who fight you for the cause of faith. Because fighting may have different causes, many worldly causes, but someone who fights us for the sake of faith, then of course, إِنَّمَا يَنْهَاكُمُ اللَّهُ عَنِ الَّذِينَ قَاتَلُوكُمْ فِي الدِّينِ وَأَخْرَجُوكُمْ مِنْ دِيَارِكُمْ وَظَاهَرُوا عَلَىٰ أَخْرَاجِكُمْ. Those who killed you, fought you, those who drove you out of your homes, those who helped them in driving you out of your home, that you should not affiliate with them politically, you should not affiliate with them in any sense, and tawallawhum. So, here what we say about these verses, all these four or five verses which are revealed here, first of all, it's talking in a very specific context about when people of Mecca attacked, the Prophet was of course, waiting until for revelation to come, and then revelation came that those who fight you, fight them. And when war breaks out, then of course, وَقْتُلُوهُمْ حَيْثُ ثَقَفْتُمُوهُمْ. Wherever you find them, kill them. Now, wherever you find them, it means even in the haram. This is the meaning of where you will find them. Of course, it's very clear that when war breaks out, in any battle, anywhere we find the enemy, we fight them. But here it means even in the haram. Why? Because they drove you out of the haram. They fought you in haram. You can do that. وَقْتُلُوهُمْ حَيْثُ ثَقِفْتُمُوهُمْ وَأَخْرِجُوهُمْ مِنْ حَيْثُ أَخْرَجُوكُمْ. Again, it refers to haram as well. أَخْرِجُوهُمْ مِنْ حَيْثُ أَخْرَجُوكُمْ وَالْفِتْنَةُ أَشَدُّ مِنَ الْقَتْلِ. Now, what's the meaning of fitna here? Fitna has been given two meanings. Now, before that, let me mention the view of Fakhruddin Razi about حَيْثُ ثَقِفْتُمُوهُمْ, wherever. Now, he says حَيْثُ means wherever and whenever. And it refers to permissibility of fighting them in haram and outside haram. And you see, it's very clear. It's about that area. It's about mushrikun of Mecca who fought against Muslims. So fight them wherever you find them and whenever, in Shahrul Haram or outside Shahrul Haram, when war breaks out, of course. When they start fighting you in Shahrul Haram, you fight them with Shahrul Haram. وَأَخْرَجُوهُمْ مِنْ حَيْثُ أَخْرَجُوكُمْ. It means in Mecca, from Mecca. You are allowed to expel them from Mecca because they expelled you from Mecca. وَالْفِتْنَةُ أَشَدُّ مِنَ الْغَدِ. They have given two meanings for fitna. Of course, the fitna once is mentioned here and once in a couple of verses ahead. One meaning of fitna they have given is shirk or kufr, faithlessness. And they have made some sort of justification why they call kufr or shirk to be fitna, because it leads to destruction of soul and such things is fitna. But apparently, this is again a justification for fighting all mushrikun, whether they attack us or not attack us. While fitna here is very, in this context, it means what they did to you and what they are doing to you is more severe than killing. They expelled you from your home, they tortured you, they fought against you, they did not let you to enter haram and do your hajj. So all these fitna, you remember all this? So you may think, why should we shed blood? Shedding blood, of course, is very bad. But when you have this distress, this affliction, this distress and affliction is worse than qatl and killing. So two meanings are mentioned here. One, shirk and faithlessness. The other is tribulation, affliction, distress, which in the context, of course, it means distress. This distress that you are in is worse than وَالْفِتْنَةُ أَشَدُّ مِنَ الْقَاتْلِ. And, of course, in the context, we may say that it's not the case that fitna in which the mushrikun are living as shirk and kuf is worse than if they are killed. It may mean that if you go to battle, this is one meaning, if you go to battle and you are killed, it's better for you than staying in this situation of distress, in the situation of affliction. And this is all sort of people who have some sort of free mind and free soul. They feel, isn't it? This is a human thing, that until when and until what time I should stay in this distress, in this misfortune situation which is afflicted upon me by oppressors. Let me go and fight. I will be killed. It's fine. Fitnatu ashaddu min al-qatl. This is another meaning that we can give. It means fitna, not that fitna is worse than you killing them. It means fitna is worse than they killing you. This may be another meaning for it. So, wal fitnatu ashaddu min al-qatl. وَلَا تُقَاتِلُوهُمْ عِنْدَ الْمَسْجِدِ الْحَرَامِ. Okay, he said, again, you see, this is very specific about Mecca. This is not going to be extended to other places. وَلَا تُقَاتِلُوهُمْ عِنْدَ الْمَسْجِدِ الْحَرَامِ. وَقْتُلُهُمْ حَيْثُ ثَقِفْتُمُهُمْ meant kill them in Haram. That's fine. But in the Masjid al-Haram, in Masjid al-Haram, do not kill them. Until if start fighting with you there. In other places in Haram, you know that Haram is much wider than Mecca and Masjid al-Haram. In other places in Haram, if you find them, you start fighting with them. But in Masjid al-Haram, do not fight them because this is a place of sanctity. Unless they start fighting you in Masjid al-Haram. It means Masjid al-Haram has its respect. If they keep the respect of Masjid al-Haram, if they honor it, you honor it. If they do not honor it, you go ahead. So, وَلَا تُقَاتِلُوهُمْ عِنْدَ الْمَسْجِدِ الْحَرَامِ حَتَّى يُقَاتِلُوكُمْ فِيهِ. But do not fight them near the holy mosque unless they fight you. فَإِنْ قَاتَلُوكُمْ فَاقْتُلُوهُمْ. If they fight you, then kill them. ذَا كَذَلِكَ جَزَاءُ الْكَافِرِينَ. It is such that, such is the recruitment of the faithless, means even in Masjid al-Haram, we do not keep any respect for their blood if they start fighting with you. Then, because everything is respected in Masjid al-Haram. Everything should be respected there. However, if they fight you, if they do not respect, then their requital is the punishment is that you kill them there as well. Again, another verse says, فَإِنِنْ تَهَوْ. If they stop, فَإِنِنْ تَهَوْ فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ غَفُورٌ رَحِيمٌ. It's a declaration of war against the mushrikun who started fighting. Now, Allah says, if stopped fighting, if they stop fighting, then you stop. You do not continue the battle. فَإِنْ انْتَهَوْا فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ غَفُورٌ رَحِيمٌ. But if they relinquish, then Allah is indeed all forgiving, all merciful. Now, here, فَإِنْ انْتَهَوْا, if they stop, stop what? Again, those exegetes who say that it is about shirk, it's not about transgression. They say Ibn Abbas, Hassan al-Basri says, فَإِنْ انْتَهَوْا, if they stop, and shirk, if they stop, idolatry. It means you fight them until you finish them all, unless they believe. But Ibn Abbas says, فَإِنْ انْتَهَوْا الْقِتَال, if they stop fighting. So it's not the case that because they are mushrik, we kill them. But if they stop fighting you, you stop fighting them. فَإِنْ انْتَهَوْا فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ غَفُورٌ رَحِيمٌ. Allah is forgiving, merciful. Let them be. Now, Fakhruddin Razi says that, Ibn Abbas says, if they stop fighting. Hassan al-Basri says, if they stop shirk, if they stop idolatry. Then he says, how can we justify these two? He says, the justification of the view of Abdullah ibn Abbas, rahmatullah alayhi, is that the whole idea of issuing permission for fight to Muslims is to stop being attacked, is the whole idea. Now, if they stop attacking you, then you stop. You stop fighting them. How can we justify the view of Hassan al-Basri? Is that he says, "Inna Allah ghafurun rahim," isn't it? But would the ghufran of Allah, include the kuffar? No. So the ghufran of Allah only includes them when they stop kufr, not they stop fighting. Again, it's a very convoluted way of argument, isn't it? It's very difficult to justify in that way. The verses are very clear. You fight those who fight you, fight wherever you find them. If they stop, فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ غَفُورٌ رَحِيمٌ. Now, even if we say that if they stop fighting, not if they stop shirk, if they stop fighting, again, some exegetes say that the following verse has abrogated this. وَقَاتِلُوهُمْ حَتَّى لَا تَكُونَ فِتْنَةً. Fight them unless there is no fitna, and fitna is shirk. So it's very interesting. One verse is revealed, the following verse abrogates it. Another verse is revealed, the following verse is abrogating. What sort of Quran are we reading? I mean, what sort of idea was there in the mind of these exegetes about nasakh and abrogation? Unless if we say that there was something they wanted to justify, and that was justification of the wars which happened after the Prophet, peace be on him. It's very interesting. All the battles after the Prophet was fighting conquering lands and other territories, except at the time of Imam Ali, that all his fighting was with Muslims. It's very interesting. If we think about it, all his fighting were with Muslims rather than going for conquest and fighting other people. And this is something that we have really to think about in history. Why Imam Ali was fighting Muslims rather than fighting mushrikun, other people outside, giving money, booties to people to go and fight and take. These people really went for booties. It's very well known. It's not something that Shia say, that once the whole Khums of Africa came, the whole Khums of Africa, how many millions of dinar it was, we don't know, came to Uthman. He gave all of it to Marwan. Take it. It's, as Imam Ali says, يَخْذَمُونَ مَالَ اللَّهِ خَذْمَ الْإِبْلِ نَبْتَةَ الْبَنِي نَبْتَةَ الْرَبِي. They were eating, devouring the wealth that Allah has placed for the poor. They were devouring for themselves. This was, why shouldn't they go and fight mushrikun? Why shouldn't they go and fight other nations who, to say, we want to call you to Islam, when they could accrue such a wealth? And then they distributed amongst themselves, among Banu Umayyah. It was the case. When these negotiators were coming to Uthman, and they were negotiating because there were people uprising. They had come from Egypt, from other places, and they wanted justice from Uthman. And then Imam Ali sent negotiators. He himself came to negotiate that relinquish. These people want justice, relinquish. What should I do? What have I done? You have given all these wealth and booties to your family. They want it to be distributed. He said, the Prophet preferred Banu Hashim over others. I prefer Banu Umayyah over others. And if, this is well written in the history, if the keys of paradise was in my hand, were in my hand, I would have given to Banu Umayyah. So you want to do it? Okay. You give everything to Banu Umayyah, then of course we have to justify these things, isn't it? So, وَقَاتِلُوهُمْ وَقَاتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ الَّذِينَ يُقَاتِلُونَكُمْ. Not anyone that is just sitting in other places in their countries, you go and fight them. Is this really for Islam? Or is this for Khums, booties of the war, bringing to you, giving it to, distributing even unfairly. Now, so وَقَاتِلُوهُمْ حَتَّى لَا تَكُونَ فِتْنَةً, cannot be an abrogator of فَإِنْ انْتَهَوْا فَلَا عُدْوَانَ فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ غَفُورٌ رَحِيمٌ. If they stop, Allah is غَفُورٌ رَحِيمٌ. It means you fight them until there is no distress and affliction. Yes, they stop. They say, okay, we don't fight you. You are free to have your faith. Leave us free. Okay, we leave you free. And of course, it doesn't mean that they are right in whatever they want to do. It doesn't mean that we believe that, yes, every faith should be respected. No, no. Every faith cannot be respected, but can be tolerated, but cannot be respected. But it means that we don't want to bring people to Islam by force. We don't want to bring them by force. It's very interesting. There is a fatwa from Shafi'i who says that if a Muslim man marries a non-Muslim woman, a kitabiyah, one of Ahlul Kitab, he should not request her to become a Muslim. Why? Because there is this suspicion of karaha. She may feel compulsion to come to Islam, and la ikraha fi din. We do not want to bring people to Islam by compulsion. It's not possible. And of course, this la ikraha fi din has been interpreted in very wrong ways as well. Like, for example, even the laws of Islam should not be implemented because no one should be forced to follow the laws. No, in Muslim community, we have enforced the laws of Islam. That's not the meaning of La Ikraha Fid-Din. It means that you cannot bring people to Islam by force. Anyhow, وَقَاتِلُوهُمْ حَتَّى لَا تَكُونَ فِتْنَةٌ وَيَكُونَ الدِّينُ لِلَّهِ. And fight them until there is no trouble, there is no distress. They stop annoying you. As I said, if we say that fitna means shirk, means you fight them until all of them become Muslims. وَيَكُونَ الدِّينُ لِلَّهِ. And deen can be for Allah. Now, again here, it can be interpreted that everyone should believe in Allah until everyone believes in Allah. But we can interpret it in another way. يَكُونَ الدِّينُ لِلَّهِ means that you can follow your faith for Allah freely so that you are not troubled and bullied by others. Again, فَإِنْ تَهَوْا, if they stop, فَلَا عُدْوَانَ إِلَّا عَلَى الظَّالِمِينَ, then there is no reprisal except against the wrongdoers. Now, again, this can be interpreted in two ways, isn't it? فَإِنْ تَهَوْا مِنَ الشَّرْكِ means you fight them until they believe. فَإِنْ تَهَوْا from creating fitna, then you stop fighting. So, just in conclusion, the following verse, of course, is a continuation. We leave it for next week. In conclusion, there are two views about these verses, this set of verses, which have all been revealed together. One view is that it means that you have to fight mushrikun until they become Muslims, and then we should have several abrogations there. One verse abrogating the other verse abrogating the other. Or it means that fight them unless they do not create trouble for you. And you only start fighting if they begin to fight you. Otherwise, you are not allowed. And this is corroborated by the verse in Surah Tahrim, which has come to Surah Mumtahana, which has come towards the end of Prophet's life, just before the conquest of Mecca. لَا يَنْهَاكُمُ اللَّهُ عَنِ الَّذِينَ لَمْ يُقَاتِلُوكُمْ فِي الدِّينِ. Allah would not prohibit you to befriend with those who did not fight you in faith and did not drive you out of your homes. Inshallah, we leave the next verse for next week. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa alayhi ta'ala.
Thank you, Honorable Jindid Sheikh. Any brothers, sisters wants to open up the discussion? Any brother?
Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Thank you very much indeed for that. So, Sheikh, obviously these verses need a lot of thinking and contemplation, and certainly, inshallah, we'll go back and do that. But just for today, I'm still not completely sure whether these verses are specifically for the mushrikun of Makkah, which you seem to imply, or whether there is a possibility that they could be generalized. Because then we can see that there's a conflict between those who attack you and those who do fitna, and then you could see the line of, or the flow of thought of perhaps the Kharijites of history or even of today for the justification of saying what they did. So I think one thing I need to be clear about is it specifically for that, or can it be generalized?
Yes, very good question. Well, the famous maxim here is that the sha'an nuzul, the cause of revelation or the occasion of revelation, would not restrict the meaning of the verse. It should be generalized to other cases. But when we generalize, we have to be careful how we generalize it, to which cases we generalize. We shouldn't generalize to verses which are not included in this occasion, which are not similar to this occasion. In the case of what Allama Tabatabai says about إِنَّ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا سَوَاءٌ عَلَيْهِمْ أَأَنذَرْتَهُمْ, he says this is not about every kafir. This is about mushrikun of Mecca. Yes, then anyone in history, in the future, who comes like them, it includes them. They are stubborn, they do not want to believe. Any ayah they see, they reject. And these verses, the same thing. it has been revealed about Mushrikun of Mecca. But if we are in a situation where other people are attacking us, they're creating fitna for us, they're creating distress for Muslims, and the same situation as that time comes about, of course, it's not, we cannot bring every element because it talks about Masjidul Haram and Haram and such things. And so not the same thing can come about. But any situation in which we are, which is similar to that, which people attack you without you provoking them, then of course the same thing. So when we have to generalize it, the Quran is not for one specific time and one specific place. But when we generalize, we have to be very careful. We do not generalize it wrongly.
And I think this is the crux of the dilemma that many of us face, because on the one hand, yes, war hasn't broken out, and we accept that. But then it also depends on the definition of war. I mean, there are a lot of forces in the world today who are very much against Islam, who are using every part of their ability to fight Islam, to bring about misconceptions of Islam, to bring about hatred of Muslims. So is there a responsibility of Muslims to retaliate against that or not?
Yeah, retaliate is good. But retaliate by the same means, not retaliate by fighting. You cannot do that, of course. And when we come to the next verse, which says, "Ash-shahru al-haram bi-shahri al-anwar hurumatu qisas," any violation should be responded in the same way. So yes, of course, we do. Unless if they make an open sort of attack or an open declaration of war, which has happened. I mean, Palestinian people have been driven out of their homes openly. So that's a different case. But for others, of course, we are not allowed to fight and go to battle. But yes, of course, retaliating, reacting, all these things are necessary and are wajib to do. But starting a fight is something different.
Thank you. Any sisters? No sister, brothers? Yeah, Riyad, can you take?
Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Pretty big subject. We're looking forward to next week. For now, could you please explain, when it says in the Allah Ghafur Rahim, somebody who has wronged, and if they stop fighting you, I'm only dealing with what's in front of me just now. If they stop fighting you, then Allah is Ghafur Rahim. So just like you said, we should forgive people who have not been fighting you. That's fine after the conquest of Mecca. But somebody who has visibly killed Muslims then comes up to the criminal courts of human rights or things like that. So after a war, is it then not promoted for human beings to take justice in their own hands?
No, al-hurumat wa qisas. If hurumat, which are the things which are respected in human community, whether it's life or lives of people, then for that there is qisas. But in every war, it's like that. You see, when وَإِن جَنَحُوا لِلسَّلْمِ فَاجْنَحْ لَهَا وَتَوَكَّلْ عَلَى اللَّهِ. Again, they say this verse is abrogated. I mean, we cannot accept that all these verses are abrogated. If they offer peace, accept it, even if you think that this is a trap, if you somehow, you are suspicious, تَوَكَّلْ عَلَى اللَّهِ. But peace is always better than war. So even if they suggest peace, you accept it. I mean, in every war, people kill people, and we cannot just go after every single person and say, because you were in the war battlefield, we want to make qisas. It's not possible. You make peace, that's fine. So, yeah, continue.
Of course, that brings to mind immediately the talk about that we had about Rajayat, and you said, okay, if one person did kill somebody, because at the end of the day, next week we will be discussing how the mentality of the Bani Umayyah were turned against Imam Hussein because of ayat such as this. So we will discuss that, but for the time being, when you said something about, so if somebody you know has killed somebody and then war finishes, and is it then...
Killed in the battlefield.
Yes.
Well, killing in the battlefield, you go to battlefield to kill. Then after that, you do not actually bring everyone who were in the battlefield to criminal courts. It's not a criminal action, it's war. War is different from criminal action, is it? Isn't it?
Well, I would have thought so, but you know, when people talk about Rajayat and then whatever happened after Imam Hussein's Karbala. After Karbala, people who had killed were picked out.
Yes.
After the event of Karbala, the perpetrators were picked out and punished.
Oh, I see. Okay. No, that's a different. That was in another war, in another battle. They were actually fighting to get these people. That's a different matter. And they had not proposed peace. And it's a different thing. It was not a war. It was a massacre. War is different from massacre, you see. And yes, of course, if you round up a few people and kill them, without them wanting to fight you, then, of course, that's a criminal action. But when two countries go against each other in war, and you take prisoners of war, do you kill them? Are we allowed to kill prisoners of war? We are not allowed. But what they did was massacre. It was not war.
Thank you. Any sisters?
Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Sheikh, one thing I don't understand is that, you know, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in I think Surah Fatah, He promises the people that after the killing they will be getting a lot of the booty. This is, I think, wa'ada Allahu maganima kathiratan. So it's sort of a reward? Or, I mean, I'm a bit confused as to why Allah has said that He will reward them a lot of the booty after the killing, after war. The believers, He's talking to the believers.
It's not after the killing, of course. This is about Khaybar, when they actually were gathering force to attack Muslims, and Prophet preempted that. That's quite reasonable. If people are gathering force to fight you, you do not wait. As I mentioned last time, preemptive action is allowed. You know people are gathering force to fight you, you don't allow them to gather force. Otherwise, there is more killing, isn't it? So when they went there, of course, Allah is telling them, in your next war, you are going to, which is a war after provocation, then, of course, you are going to take lots of booties. Muslims of Medina were all poor. There's nothing wrong with booties of war, if it's just war. If it's unjust war, then, of course, if the battle is for booties, it's not. But if we have a fight for any other reason...
But wasn't it like encouraging them to fight because they will get the booties? Do you know, I'm a bit not sure how that...
No, at the time of the Prophet, this cannot happen.
Okay.
At the time of the Prophet especially, this cannot happen. It was just because Prophet was there, and it was a sort of prophecy to support the heart of Muslim women, that you are going to have a big victory. And this was to somehow console them because of the humiliation that they received at the hand of Mushrikun in Hudaybiyah. You know, it was humiliating for them not being allowed to go to Mecca. They were muhram. And that's why Prophet wanted a second bay'ah from them. They didn't want to follow the Prophet. They said, no, we fight them. We fight. And Prophet said, whoever believes in me should come and renew the bay'ah. So it was so very humiliating for them. Now, after that, Allah says, don't worry. There are good things for you to come. You are going to defeat your enemies. You are going to take lots of booties. So I don't think this would imply that war is justifiable for booties.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Sarfraz.
Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Sheikh, there's a translation here of fitna as persecution.
Yes.
And if you use that one, then it becomes very general as well.
Yeah, it's just like trouble and distress,
so
persecution.
When people stop persecuting you, then you don't have to fight.
Yeah. Persecution is a very good translation for it.
And the other point is, I remember when you were doing Tafsir Surah Tawbah, and similarly when it exhorts people to fight, the point you were making there is Allah is saying to this to people, because they didn't want to fight, they just didn't want to, and He's saying, come, what's the matter with you? Fight.
Yeah.
Would the same apply here?
This is actually a sort of initiation of permission. The permission is issued. There, after they had fought many battles, now they had somehow became lethargic to go to war and such things, is encouraging them. We can say that if they follow the same team, yes. وَاَقْتُلُوهُمْ حَيْثُ ثَقَفْتُمُوهُمْ.
Yeah,
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you for the interesting lecture. There are two, three things. I don't know whether you have seen, there's so much of video going on today about killing Muslim Day. It's in the news this morning, and it's very frightening. You know, there's been so much videos all over the UK, has been going on, asking people, literally asking people to kill Muslim, and people are clapping it. And there's a huge amount of crowd going on. It's on the BBC News this morning as well. That's also very frightening. How are we going to cope with this? Another thing is, when there is this sort of ayat, and the one there is another said, you can hit your wife. So much sort of non-Muslim people, you can hit your wife if she disobey you.
Eat your wife.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's what, it's one of the verses. They literally translate one to one, yeah. I mean, it's very difficult for to them to...
You know, the point is, the Quran has given us rulings, which has to be explained by the Prophet, isn't it? It's very interesting you brought up this verse about beating, because it is absolutely misunderstood. You know, Allah tells us, pray. Isn't it? Then we don't know how to pray, isn't it? The Prophet should tell us how to pray. Allah tells us you are allowed to beat your wives, okay? We don't know how. Punch them, slap them, kill them, okay? Now, the Prophet explains this for us. Actually, this is abolishing a custom which was amongst the Arabs, that immediately anything happened, they started to beat the wives. The food was salty, beat the wife. Why you, for example, could Now, beating mentioned, okay, because they were using, practicing. They are practicing nowadays, not only in Muslim communities, in every community. I read a statistic, Finland has the highest rate of domestic violence, beating wives, among the non-Muslims. So, then Prophet said, okay, how to beat? With sawak, something which would not leave any mark. The Prophet explained it for us, just like prayer. How to pray? So, when I want to beat my wife, for example, how should I beat you? You just caress her, isn't it? It's like something like that. And then, not that even before you have to go through a process, it's not just something coming out of anger. You cannot do it. And can you repeat it? Or is only once for the sake of keeping the family together? You see, I think it's very important that when we see a verse in the Quran, of course, at the beginning, it seems very like these verses about killing kuffar, isn't it? Mm. Kill them wherever you fight them, find them. Okay, we are told then how it should be applied. And Prophet told us about that beating. I think that verse, in a sense, eliminates domestic violence rather than bringing domestic violence in the way the Prophet and the Imams explained it. And it was never practiced by Prophet, never practiced by any Imam. And Prophet says any believing person would never beat their wife. So I think this verse is there to explain for us how we have to treat our wives with the mentality that all men have. It's not only for that time, everywhere. There was a difference between people of Mecca and Medina in that. People of Mecca had more domestic violence than people of Medina, even before Islam. And when they migrated, Omar was saying that these people are very soft to their wives and to their family. We have to be harsher. So the verse is explained to us by the Prophet how it should be.
Thank you very much. Any brothers?
Isn't it a prophet?
Just me.
Prophet Ayub alayhi salam, who sort of tried to beat his wife.
Yeah. Again, Allah explained for him how to punish her. Just take a handful of straws and just once put on her, isn't it? وَاضْرِبْ بِهِ وَلَا تَعْنَثْ, isn't it? Just beat once. And that was not for beating. That was for actually a wrong that he thought should be punished socially, which of course Allah somehow took it out.
Thank you. Any sisters? No?
Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. You mentioned about how some of the conquests after the Prophet were not necessarily done for religious purposes, but more for conquest of territory and countries and so on. And then you contrasted that with the situation during Imam Ali's time, where the Muslims were fighting Muslims, as you say. I've often heard discussions where people have questioned that if these territories were conquered for the sake of booty and expansion and so on, one is by appointing governors and so on, Imam Ali accepted in that sense, the legitimacy of those newly conquered spaces, number one. And secondly, when I sort of think about it, you kind of say that the so-called Islamic world that we have now, some of it was conquered through those means. So personally, I think that, you know, when people say, you know, we've got this huge Islamic world and so on, perhaps Allah's intention was through this course, or was it through, you know, other means?
Well, we have a hadith from the Prophet, لا يزال يؤيد هذا الدين بالرجل الفاسق. Allah would support this faith with fusaq. They were fusaq. They did it. Okay? They did it for their own intention. They are not going to be rewarded for it, of course. But what happened is this. And we don't know if it didn't happen in this way, it wouldn't have happened in other ways. You know, Islam was a very fast-growing religion. It made sense. It was easy. It was based on fitrah of people. We don't know even if the conquests were not there, it would have not spread so fast as it did. And sometimes these conquests didn't work, isn't it? Like in the case of Spain. It didn't work. Of course, there was one thing always in the mind of Muslims, that Ahlul Kitab should not be coerced to believe in Islam. And when they went to Spain, it was the same thing. They never coerced Ahlul Kitab to bring them to Islam. But whether they did it for booty or not, or for land, certainly did it for land. And whether it was successful or not, in some places it ended up in conversion, in some places it didn't end up in conversion.
India is a good example too, you know, ruled by the Mughals for many
for several years. Hundred years, it did not years. They did not convert, yeah.
Thank you. Any sisters? Sir Fred?
Sheikh, just to make a point on that, if you look at Indonesia, it's a Muslim country. If you look at Malaysia, it's a Muslim country. Philippines was a Muslim country until the Portuguese forcibly converted them to Christianity. None of these places were visited by Muslim soldiers. So Islam would spread far and wide by whatever means. And this is an example.
That's true. Even now, if you think about religions in the world, you would see, I mean, the most appealing religion, which makes sense, and people would somehow accept it willingly, rationally, is this religion. Other religions, of course, Judaism is very similar, but it has become a sort of ethnic, has found ethnic identity. Otherwise, I think we shouldn't think if there were no conquests, Islam wouldn't have spread. I think this is a wrong idea.
Thank you. Any sisters? Any brothers? So just summarize for me to understand, there is no abrogation of any ayat in the Quran, except there is one.
This is disputable among ulama, as I said. Some ulama believe there is no abrogation. Some have limited it. There are some people who say there are more than 250 verses abrogated in the Quran. And some people like Jalaluddin Suyuti, for example, says there are only 20 verses. Ayatollah Khoi says there is only one verse. And as I mentioned, Abu Muslim Isfahani, Bahr al-Isfahani, says that there was no abrogation at all. And everything they explain. Like, for example, let me give you one example. وَاللَّاتِ يَأْتِينَ الْفَاحِشَةَ مِنْ نِسَائِكُمْ فَأَمْسِكُوهُنَّ فِي الْبُيُوتِ حَتَّى يَتَوَفَّاهُنَّ الْمَوْتِ أَوْ يَجْعَلَ اللَّهُ لَهُنَّ سَبِيلًا. Those ladies who commit indecency, keep them in the houses until they die, or Allah puts a way for them. Now, they say this verse has been abrogated by Ayatul Zina. By Rajm and also the lashes, Ayatul Jalt. Now, it's quite disputable whether this is about the women who commit zina or it's about the women, the lesbians. There's a strong view here that it's about lesbians. The women who are lesbian and who commit this, practice this, keep them in the house, don't let them mix with other women. Okay? This is their punishment, actually. Keep them in the house, don't let them mix with other women until they die. So they have to be in their houses. They shouldn't be out until, of course, there's a change. There's a change, sex change or something like that. And then the following verses, وَالَّذَانَ يَأْتِيَانَهَا مِنْكُمْ فَعَذُوهُمَا. This is, again, about homos. It's not about men who commit zina. So if we follow that line, it means that those verses have not abrogated these verses. And those who say there is no abrogation in the Quran, they explain all these verses in different ways so that there is no abrogation.
Thank you very much. Any brothers or sisters?
Assalamu alaikum. This actually opens up a new Pandora for me about lesbian you mentioned and the gays and whatever. So what's this? I mean, maybe this is taking it to a different angle, but what's the verdict of Islam on that aspect? Are they supposed to be kept in a closed environment and things of that sort, rather than...
Which one, lesbians or gays?
There is a difference?
Well, it says about women, keep them
okay,
in the house.
Fair enough, yes.
Because men could not be kept in the house, isn't it? Yeah, there's a difference. Well, you know, homosexuality definitely is a sin in Islam. Definitely, there is no question about it. How the society would treat that? Of course, homosexuality as a tendency is a biological thing. But practicing it, which encourages this and brings others in as well, practicing it is certainly a sin. Now, how society is going to somehow react to this? What is the punishment? This is based on different situations. It is actually to the Muslim authorities and Islamic government to say what sort of deterrence we have to put for it. So, putting aside the punishment, we are not talking about punishment. Is this a sin like fornication? Of course, it's a sin like fornication. Is this a sin like adultery? Yes, it's a sin like adultery. But how to treat, what to do, that's a different matter.
Because you mentioned about sex change as well. That's something, until they do that and then they come out of the house or whatever. So that was also interesting, meaning that this may be a solution?
It's possible. Now it's being done as well, that some people change their sex from male to female, female to male, because of the sort of type of biological tendencies that they have.
So is that an actual thing that happened? That when they were born in a different, like they say, that we are born as a man while we should have been born a woman or something like that, or vice versa?
Since the early days, there were in Islamic fiqh, they had this discussion about khunsa. A person who was not known whether is male or female, or was neutral, okay? And there are lots of rulings with regards to that. How should we determine the sex of a person if they are in this situation? And sometimes they came across cases which they really could not, because they have two sort of genitals, and for men and for women. They came to very, very difficult situations, how to determine what sex this person has. And they have discussed that as well. Court actually, the court rules about the sex of a person. They had to go to court and such things. So there's no denial that biologically some people are different. There hasn't ever been denial in history. But how they have to, like for example, some people are pedophile, okay? They like children pornography and such things. But whether we have to allow them to practice it, that's a different matter. And we know that in modern society, we never allow it. It's a big crime. Now, in Muslim society, in the same way, practicing homosexuality is not allowed, is a sin. Not only in Islam, in every religion, in Christianity, in Judaism, it has been a sin. As I said, how the society wants to deal with it, what are the legal implications of this, what are the punishments, that's left to the state to decide about it.
Thank you. Thank you, Muhammad Wa Ali Muhammad Salwat. I think we have run out of our time. So inshallah, we meet next Sunday. Inshallah.